Hello and welcome to the DebtWire podcast. I'm your host, Madalina Jakob, co-managing editor of DebtWire North America. I'm really excited about today's conversation. I'm joined by three distinguished guests who sit at the center of today's credit and restructuring market, but from very different seats. We have first up, Waris Anifowoshi, head of restructuring at Fortress Investment Group, Kevin Fortunato, portfolio manager at Benefit Street Partners, where he invests in CLOs and also sits on the investment committee for special situations, and Scott Greenberg, global head of restructuring at Gibson Dunn and a member of the firm's executive committee. Thanks all for joining us today. Let's start with your journey. How did each of you first find your way into credit and restructuring?
Happy to start off. I found my way in here by graduating right during the Great Recession. And so when I took my first job over at Barclays, I just purchased Lehman. I was put on the securitized products desk. And at that point, everything was a stress. And from a series of events from there, ended up following this path that kind of led me to where that I am. I feel like my career started with things that were distressed, and it's just branched into various roles. Did the JD MBA route, saw the law side, saw the business side, decided I want to focus a little bit more on the business side. And from there, one thing led to another, and that's where I'm here now.
And then you also worked at Evercore, right?
Worked at Evercore on the advisory side. Been at Fortress now for over 5 years. I had done the ABI competition back when I was younger, which kind of piqued my curiosity in restructuring. It's funny, accidentally, I ended up doing all the roles that are really helpful for what I do today. I saw what it looked like on the trading side and the sales side. I saw what it looked like on the advisory side. I learned how lawyers like to talk and think. And so that's been very helpful to my role today.
Right, Kevin?
Sure. So I started my career at Deutsche Bank in the investment banking division, focused on power and utilities. We obviously worked across all products, M&A, equity, and credit. But Deutsche being a debt house, we spend a lot of time in leverage loans and high yield. Most notable work that I had at that point was the tail end of the TXU bankruptcy. Deutsche did a lot on the TCH silo. That is where I spent the bulk of my time during my first few years, and was a great foundation within the space. I then transitioned over to Benefit Street, where I became an investor, focused on all of our products at the time. And I got to work with a guy by the name of Mike Pache, who was a mentor for me. It taught me a lot on portfolio management, managing the tails within your portfolios, and brought me along to focus on a lot of the restructurings and workouts that were going on in the private side of the business.
Scott?
Specifically, as it relates to restructuring, a little bit of happenstance. I think I always knew I wanted to be a lawyer. Maybe I just liked to argue a lot as a kid, and that continued. And I got involved in mock trials and moot court and all those things, even at a young age in high school. So the legal profession always seemed to be my calling. Restructuring, not so much, honestly. I went to Emory for law school. My first summer internship, or I guess my 2L summer internship, which is where you normally land your big law job, was at Weil Gotshal. I actually wasn't really interested in restructuring. Believe it or not, I was very interested in tax. I really liked the code, liked a lot of the partnership tax, the math behind it. And when I was at Weil this summer, at least I used to work back then, is you rotate through departments. And I picked it as my last choice. I'm here, it's Weil Gotshal. I may as well at least give it a try. I'd never taken a restructuring course prior to that summer job. And first thing I got staffed on was Sunbeam Corporation with Harvey Miller. At the time, probably had no idea who Harvey was. And he took a liking to me and very quickly pulled me into his team. I don't think I really made it out of the rotation of restructuring, even though theoretically I was supposed to be rotating. And that was it. And I loved it. The quick pace, the trial by fire approach was great. It was a massive time commitment. So it certainly wasn't the lifestyle that maybe tax would have provided, but it was extremely interesting to me. So I walked backwards into it and got very lucky, obviously, with who I landed as a mentor.
You mentioned you started your career with Harvey Miller, one of the most influential and respected bankruptcy lawyers in the world, I can say. And this year, you're being recognized at UJA's Harvey Miller honoree. So it really feels like one of those rare full cycle moments, especially given how much the restructuring world has changed since you started.
Harvey was a massive influence. He is why I am here today. So for me, it is a bit of full circle. So I'm pretty excited about that.
So before we jump into the market dynamics, just for our listeners to better understand the lens that each of you bring to the table, can you explain the scope of your role today and how you interact with stress and distress at Fortress, Gibson, and Benefit?
Sure. So today I'm a portfolio manager at BSP. BSP's grown quite a bit. So we have more than $90 billion that spans liquid and illiquid credit products in the U.S. and in Europe. My responsibilities focus on managing the CLO portfolios in the U.S. and sitting on the IC for special situations and capital solutions. The view on risk is always interesting. Obviously, the products are quite different, but there's a commonality in that everything starts with the credit. Our underwriting process focuses a lot on forecasting financials. We like to get grindy, and frankly, we're credit geeks. This is what we like to do. But the key difference is understanding your mandate. CLOs are focused on par preservation, NAV preservation. We look to achieve lower risk metrics than our peers, and with our tight liabilities, pay a healthy distribution to the equity. And we think that preserves a lot of the optionality the structure affords investors, and that's long-term MOM potential. For special situations, it's obviously a more concentrated book that's focused in hairier parts of the market. I think where our team's had a lot of success, it is credit selection, knowing when to get involved in certain situations and what's the catalyst that you're playing for. And then two is really leveraging the platform and originating self-sourcing ideas in liquid and illiquid products. And I think that lends itself to creating an interesting portfolio and return profile that has been attractive to our investors.
On my side, I'm the head of restructuring at Fortress, and that kind of role is a bit of a broad role. So for any of our things that kind of fall into that restructuring, distress, special situation, I usually get involved with the team. This will work on things both defensively and offensively. It's the way I like to think about it. The defensive stuff is some of the things that Kevin mentioned where it's like, all right, whether we need amendments or LMEs or Chapter 11s or anything that's in our existing portfolio to ensure that we maximize value for our LPs on a defensive basis. And on the offensive side, it's the same thing, similar situations, but it might be a situation that we're not in, that we've been monitoring. We think there's an opportunity, which kind of falls more on the special situation side. It might be a situation that we are in and that we recognize that actually doing X, Y, and Z might be beneficial to the CLO, might be beneficial to one of the opportunities funds that we have. And so it's a dynamic thing, but think of it as a job is 50% defense, 50% offense. The defense is the stuff that you guys love to write about in your publications. That's like the groups, that's the, I'm talking with lawyers, FAs, the LMEs, all that stuff that we're going to get into later. And then the offensive stuff is kind of like the bread and butter credit stuff that he's talking about. Hey, like this has dropped a lot, but we actually really like it. We think that after this transaction, it might get upgraded. We'll go from triple C, goes to B minus. There could be a lot of value there. It could be a special situation like, hey, for one of the opportunities on the lending fund, this is great risk. You can provide new money for the company, non-fungible incrementals, things of that nature. And so it expands that breadth, but the point of it is to basically anything in the restructuring distress world, whether it's defensively or offensively work. And I do that across portfolio, the public credit and private credit. And so there's always something to do. There's always something happening. It's a really great dynamic role. As I said beforehand, like I'm grateful for kind of the past experiences I've had that kind of set me up to understand them. The advisory side at Evercore and that team, and you know, the trading and sales side at Barclays and everything in between.
Look, at heart, I think we're all still deal junkies to a certain respect. We love working the deals, and I still do love that dynamic. Obviously, as I get older and my position has evolved, so has my role internally. And so what I've tried to do, we're always looking 12 months out, right? When we think of like our work log and what's coming down the pike. But I think I've stepped back a bit in the sense of trying to build a more global footprint, both in terms of geographically, right? So we've spent a lot of time because it was very obvious to me that Europe was a natural place to go with what we're doing here and all the work that a bunch of us here are doing in the US, whether it's LME or all this other stuff was eventually going to make its way across the pond. So building out our practices to be ready for that growth, which I think we have pretty well in Europe, and then candidly building for the future, right? And these guys know my team well, really giving our next generation more limelight, more time to shine, more visibility in the marketplace, whether it's doing things like this or just running deals candidly. Because Gibson's been around, it's a great firm for a very long time, but the restructuring practice, I think, is really coming to its own only since 2019. And so my goal eventually when I hang it up is to leave a practice that continues in perpetuity and doesn't go by the wayside with just certain individuals. And so I think in addition to the day job, in addition to working the deals, exercising some of the influence we have within the firm to build out the platform.
You just announced, you're talking about expanding across the pond. You just announced yesterday, I think, a big hire from Kirkland, a lawyer from Kirkland that's joining your group, a partner with a lot of experience in EU restructurings.
So our team in France has always been historically very strong and a market leader. We did a lot of hiring in the UK last year, with the team that we brought across from Sullivan. And then the one jurisdiction I think is pretty busy in Europe that we were missing was Germany. And so Leo basically built Kirkland's restructuring practice over there over two decades. So the best in class. I'm very happy about.
Great. So now that we know the perspective that each of you is bringing to the table, I want to narrow it down and ask you if there are two or three topics or themes that matter most to you right now as you position yourself into 2026. This could be more macro, structural, or very deal-specific themes.
Yeah, happy to talk about it. I think right now in the news, everyone's talking about software. At Fortress, fortunately, thanks to the great work of our analysts, we've always been underweight. This is something that like the team has always been very aware of and been very selective about, which has been fortunate because I think we've been in a little bit better position than some of our peers on that. But now hard work begins. It's analyzing, all right, which of these is oversold? Where are there opportunities? Back to what Kevin said about being credit junkies. At the end of the day, these are businesses. We sometimes, people get lost in some of the deal dynamics and that. And so really digging into the business saying, all right, there's AI risk here, but what is the AI risk? How big is it? Is it like a 5% issue, 10% issue? Is it just fundamentally going to change the business forever? So I would say there's a lot of focus right now of figuring that out. Obviously, everyone has a few software names, so it's managing those from the defensive side, but it's looking at it as an opportunity set, right? Doom and gloom typically always gets a little bit overdone. And so it's trying to figure out like the diamonds that are getting thrown out in the bathwater.
For me, it's really at the start of the year, you take a step back. The economy's in a pretty good place. For us, a lot of the pillars that we look at for economic indicators remain intact. You layer on stimulus and things feel pretty good. And the market's largely reflecting that where spreads trade. When you look at our book, we see more than 80% of our issuers are going to grow revenue and EBITDA of the year. So you take that where everything feels pretty good. But it is credit, and there are always trickier areas. And so Ori's highlighted software. We're going to get into AI at different times. Chemicals remains challenged, and the issues facing that sector are going to continue in 26. And we've been cautious around low-end consumer. And so any businesses that are levered to that customer base, areas where we're spending a lot of time with our defensive hats on, because in this market, you're not being compensated for excess risk. It's really about minimizing your losses. And so getting the losers right in that you're not in them or can position yourself as best you can is critically important.
I mean, obviously what we do, we're generalists, right? So we follow the work, but the two sectors obviously that stick out. It would have been chems for me completely until a week ago when the bottom dropped out of software. So obviously we're involved in a lot of chems names. We had a bunch of software names that have been candidly sitting around dormant for a couple of years that all of a sudden are now very topical because they've traded off 20 points. And I was having this conversation with your brother last week. I think it's just a, particularly with the software names, I think it's a question of, do they have an year-dated maturity? So now this is an actual issue. Or to Warriza's point, is this actually an opportunity set because people are overreacting in the market? I think it's the only ones I've seen really pull forward are the ones where like we have a 27 maturity and all of a sudden it trades at 75 cents. So now it's the lender's problem to solve maturity as opposed to the markets.
And the phenomenon that he's talking about there is a little bit new. It used to be that there'd be kind of a drift in prices over time as people got smart. And maybe this is an aspect of LME or some other things we can talk about. But now what you're seeing is that you have a loan go from 90 to 70 in a day and a half, which is a new phenomenon in loans. Our equity guys, they live that life every day. But loans drop now at a pace that you would never see. And some of that is, I think, the market getting smarter, people recognizing how these situations play out. I look at that as a fascinating opportunity because that's a very big change. Like on a fundamental basis, credit probably hasn't changed that much, but the dynamics have. And so depending upon where you're positioned and how you can take advantage of some of those dynamics, there's a lot of opportunities and a lot of way to think about it. And to some of the earlier points, it changes how you have to manage your portfolio, right? If you think, all right, this might drift down, I can sell slowly and figure it out. But now actually, like, I don't sell early. I might lose an extra 15, 20 points. It's a completely different portfolio management.
Well, what's driving that? Because we talked about some short sellers in the loan market and how hard that is compared to bonds. It's the dynamic behind it.
I think that the movement in pricing just reflects a different mindset in the lenders. So it used to be that how many years you want to look at it. If something started having trouble, people would talk about it, but you're really just talking about credit risk. Now there's group risk going on with that. There's co-op risk. There's different things. There's different factors. And so if you're a small lender, and particularly guys who are like index fund investors, they're in a little bit of an interesting spot because if they wait too long, given their size and dynamics, and just the likelihood that they're going to have a better than median outcome is lower. And so for them, the ability to sell is far more important. And so they're willing to take that loss then and there, crystallize it and move on, then potentially saying, I'm going to hang on to this. I'm going to see what happens. Then get in a position where they potentially might have to take more losses and it'd be a drag on the book for longer. There's a lot of
specific dynamics, especially when CLOs, in terms of timing and when things happen, that also influences. And so I think there's this recognition, and we can talk about this, of that, like, look, the world is what the world is, right? And these dynamics where they become LME in groups and formation are just part of the mosaic of how to be a credit investor. People are finally accepting that kind of on a larger scale, and they're adjusting their behavior accordingly. And I think that's why you're seeing some of that stuff.
There was a report by UBS, it's more of a hypothetical scenario, was looking at a severe AI disruption and a big raise in defaults for high yield leverage loan and private credit. And I'm just curious if you think you are envisioning such a scenario, you position yourself for something like that, or you think some of that risk is already baked in?
It's really been a turnaround value question to start off. And no matter what you're putting in everyone's fancy calculator, LTVs have gone up. If the structure was put into place with the belief that LTVs were 30 or 40%, that number's a lot higher now. And so far, it feels like it's been more of a repricing to reflect that risk, not a panic sell. What makes me a little bit nervous is the technical overhang of just how big the sector is, whether it's 12 or 16% of the liquid markets in loan land, it's a lot. And so if managers wake up and they feel it's prudent to just trim 200, 300 basis points of risk, that's a tremendous amount of trading that needs to take place and find a home. So in the near term, I think that's the overhang. As you look at defaults, I don't think we're going to see any AI-driven defaults anytime soon. Names in that sector that are going to default are defaulting because that's where they were going anyway. Those factors were in place. I think what's most interesting is going to be the maturity extensions. I think there are a lot of capital structures that the prevailing market sentiment was private debt could be an off-ramp. That just got more difficult.
I think that it's trading down so much.
Correct. There's a lot of headlines around BDCs and private credit funds having much more exposure to software than the liquid markets. And so the bar has gotten really high to take that risk. So those will be interesting processes on the A&E. And when we do get to AI-driven defaults, how is that process going to work? Is this business completely disintermediated? What are we playing for? I think the job of advisors representing the companies is to create tension in the negotiation. Do that with a third-party bid. Is that bid viable and credible for an asset that's disintermediated?
Is it like better liquidating and shutting up?
I think that's where structuring and being creative on the solution becomes important. You probably can't run the same playbook in order to maximize value for all stakeholders. And when are you supposed to have those conversations?
And I think to piggyback off that, because I agree with and bully on everything, is that when you say default, I'm asking the question, what do you mean by default? If you're saying, will liability management occur in those spaces? And I think it gets it 100%. So if that's what you're classifying as a default, I think you're going to see a ton of it. Chapter 11, I think that is primarily going to be with things in your dated maturity. Because you hit the nail on the head. The real AI risk is not tomorrow. The real AI risk is, are you going to sit there and extend out a loan till 2032, given the pace of technological change on something? That's a hard ask for somebody, whether it's private credit or the BSL market, right? If you're talking about, do people think that all of a sudden these businesses with a ton of recurring revenue are going to disappear by 2028? I agree with Kevin. I think that is extraordinarily unlikely. Might there be an example? Sure. But I think that's not very likely. I think your bigger question is, all right, look, what liability management structure makes sense? How do you protect yourself? How do you evaluate which asset is actually insulated from AI that they offer? How do you think about that? Getting to the credit stuff, like what are the contract lengths of some of these businesses? Are they already locked in? Has something dropped 30 points, but actually 90% of their customers are locked in for 5 years? So what are we actually talking about here? But I definitely think you're going to have very difficult A&E conversations. Like the value of that maturity has skyrocketed. And that, I think, is going to change the dynamics of what a sponsor can demand on the discount side. As these guys know, I hate the concept of comps when it comes to LME. So I think every situation is bespoke. But I think that in general, you should expect that the discount is going to be far less if maturity is becoming far more important.
And just to piggyback on it, do you envision that lenders are not going to be as willing to just go out as far? These are going to be much shorter band-aids because no one has a crystal ball into where we're headed.
No one has any idea what the rate of the AI disruption will be on a given name, even if they have a view as a fund or something. It's going to be a lot harder. And I think if you're a sponsor, what you're going to be looking for is as much extension and runway as possible because you need to figure out what you're dealing with. If you're a company, you need to see, all right, I need liquidity and I need time to either pivot my business model. I might have to do different type of investments. I might like overlay my own AI or whatever. But if you're a lender, the one thing that's going to be really hard for you to get is maturity. And when you were talking about LME stuff, I know we're going to get later, like the maturity still remains a very difficult thing. There are ways to incentivize people to extend maturity, to coerce people, however you want to describe it. But it's a very difficult thing to move. And so that's going to be a calculation that companies, sponsors are going to have to talk to their advisors about and see what they're going to prioritize.
I honestly, and obviously we've all been sifting through our backlog, I think realistically, we had a bunch of these names sitting around kind of soft circle for a while, but they were trading okay. And so to the point where he's made, I think everyone was hoping for maybe a private credit solution or some other off-ramp where we wouldn't have to deal with it. I think the stuff has drifted into the 70s, that off-ramp probably disappeared. So we are rehuddling on a lot of these names and figure out how we want to handle things. I think the general consensus, and you guys are the clients, you know better than me, has been like, okay, 27, 28, let's talk about anything further. Let's not deal with that for now, because obviously software got pummeled and that could come back. So you don't want to do something when you're at the trough. But I think the flip side to Warriors' point is everything's in play nowadays in the market in which we live, because now the stuff with 30, 31 maturities, maybe you don't have to deal with it, but it trades at 60. So all of a sudden it might be an LME candidate, depending on who the sponsor is behind a company.
Exactly. And we even seen something in the primary market. It was a deal that Conga was hung up, a software deal. The Deutsche Bank was left with it on the books, and then they were able to sell some. So now I guess let's switch a little bit to another topic, because you mentioned a lot of LMEs and group formation. And I want to look a little bit back at 2025 and as a tale of two markets. On one end, we had complex LMEs that were successful. I'm talking here about the cross-border historic LME of Altice France. And that was a great outcome for everyone. It ended up with an M&A. And Scott was one of the architects of this LME. But on the other hand, we saw some dramatic failures. We had First Brands free fall into Chapter 11. And then we had Saks Global filing for Chapter 11 this year, but it was unbelievable. They only paid one coupon to the bondholders and 6 months after they did the LME. So that was another big case. So the question maybe that I have is as you look ahead and you are here in 2026, do you expect this kind of large headline-driven distress to continue this year? Are we moving from some LME-driven cycle to one where more like larger restructurings are resolved in Chapter 11?
We weren't involved in Saks and we weren't involved in First Brands, so putting that out there. I would say that retail is always difficult. I have my own personal take that maybe I'll talk about some other time on that. But I think that there's a little bit of a misnomer, and I know I've talked to about that in the past, of cycles aren't really LME driven or driven by like a transaction. It's more of what's going on with the credit. And I think that there's always been this misunderstanding of LME or capital solutions or whatever people call it now. Effectively, what ends up happening is you're doing your credit analysis and then you evaluate the situation. And then you make a determination that what is the best outcome for your investment. And people say Chapter 11 as it's a panacea, being like, why don't you just file for Chapter 11? That may not be what is the best for anybody. Now, it's clearly not the best for the equity because almost by definition, they'll be wiped out. It may not be what's best for the employees because depending on when you're doing that, that might lead to more disruption for them. It could not be the best for junior creditors, unsecured creditors, and it may not be best for senior secured lenders. So I think there's a little bit of this misstatement of saying, well, if something ends in a Chapter 11, that was a failure, or something ends here, it's a success, etc. I think it's a little bit more nuanced. And it's almost a question that I can't answer in the abstract because a transaction that ends, that does an LME, but then ends in a Chapter 11 might be a failure for one person in the structure. It might be a success for somebody else, right? Kevin and I could be in the same deal, depending upon where he bought it, where I bought it, what fund it's in, what is going on, what the long-term vision is. He might view it as a success, I might view it as a failure, and vice versa. And so what I do think is going to happen is there's going to be a lot of liability management, because all liability management is, if you take a colossal step back, it's these documents have been negotiated by sophisticated parties to govern what they can do if things go wrong. You think about it, right? A credit agreement, if nothing ever goes wrong, could be a page long, right? It says like, hey, here's your coupon, here's what's going to happen. The one page, it could be a term sheet, that's it. The entire 300-page document is there specifically to outline what you should do if things do not go as planned. And effectively, if you think about it, people don't spend a ton of time figuring out all the things that are going to go wrong until they do go wrong. And so what I think you're having right now is, and this comes to the macro point that Kevin brought up earlier, is
you have a macro environment that on some metrics is doing pretty well, but on some underlying metrics, everything is more leveraged than it used to be. Rates are higher than they used to be. So if someone made a loan earlier, the situation has changed. And what you've been seeing in the last 5 years is the credit markets working to try to figure out, how do I deal with the fact that everything is a little bit more levered, everything's a little bit more expensive to do. And liability management, capital solutions, all that stuff is an attempt to try to fix that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. And Chapter 11 is a blunt tool to fix like a situation where you're like, there are no other options. I'll pause there because I know I've been speaking on that, but I do want to think from a framing perspective, it's important to break that down.
I do think you'll see a bit of an uptick in Chapter 11. Some of this will be our old LMEs, where we did them 2, 3, 4 years ago with the hope that we bought enough runway, but it really, the business hasn't turned. You fixed the balance sheet, but you didn't fix the business. So I think you will see a pickup in chapters. We've certainly seen it. But I agree with Rory's wholeheartedly. I don't think the market's going to change, because if you have time from a sponsor shareholder perspective, it always makes sense, right, to try to do the adequate deal and give it another go. And from the lender's experience, you guys know better name, when the costs associated with Chapter have just gotten so extravagant and so painful on the loan, and it's coming out of their recovery, that particularly if you're the bigger lender where you may have an opportunity to put yourself in a better position for the downside scenario than where you sit today, it probably almost always makes sense to give it a go. The ones that I've been involved in that have just crash landed into Chapter without a chance to even do that step one or things like First Brands, right? There was no saving that. And there was such an information vacuum that it was impossible. And you just needed to get it in and get it capitalized. And there's a lot of talk like, is there going to be less LME? Is there going to be more Chapter? I think it's just going forward, this is the new market where it's a combination of the two. And I don't think that's going to change in the near term.
I would agree. I do think we see more bankruptcies in 26. I think that's your failed LMEs from years prior. That cohort exists. I think the market's done a good job identifying those names in particular. You can look at trading levels and see which post LME structures don't trade well and will likely file at some point. And 2026 feels as good of a year as any, because the liquidity is typically sized for a couple of years and the time is up for certain businesses. I do think the one question, at least that I've been struggling with recently, is because so many LMEs haven't worked in terms of the turnaround of the business likely to file, is the medicine that we're giving the patient the right one? And so I get why we don't have chapters, why we have LMEs instead in transaction number one. Are all parties benefiting? At the end of the day, if the company ends up filing, no one wins. We need to put more money into the business. The tough decisions on how to improve that company weren't made. And so as a market, are we supposed to solve for something different? Are we supposed to recapitalize the businesses, recut the equity accounts in a more fair way so that everyone could participate in a turnaround of that business? Now, there's a tremendous amount of technical pressure that sponsors don't want to give up equity control of their companies. Lenders and CLO lenders in particular are very sensitive to the par haircuts and the impact on those structures. I don't think a lot of people want to wake up with 5 or 10 reorganized equity positions, because that's not a good outcome for a CLO investment vehicle. So those are real roadblocks to probably executing the right transaction for that company.
Right, because I remember some market participants saying, listen, after the company goes through 1, 2, 3 LMEs and ends up in Chapter 11, the business is so run down that it's hard to save the business in Chapter 11 rather than just doing the first time of Chapter 11 where you, as you said, you delever and fix the business, maybe reject some leases, maybe close some stores, and maybe you give them that medication in the beginning.
I agree with that if that's what happens. So I think the one thing that's being presumed there is that the Chapter 11 will result in the right capital structure. But if you're dealing with some of these names if they had done a Chapter 11 in 2022 or 2021 or whenever, they would have overlevered that business on the way out, particularly given like the structure of how CLOs want to operate. And you see that with 22s that happen afterwards. They put more debt on than they should, because it goes back to the information asymmetry and imperfect information. All of those plans are predicated upon what you think the future is going to bring, right? No one does an LME with the hope that it fails. So they did a transaction. The presumption that people are going to be making is going to be pretty similar. And if they overlever it, they're in the kind of the same boat, but they also took the $50 million of restructuring costs on.
Isn't the other issue too, though, the catalyst? Meaning, it's great for us to sit here and say, oh, we should just put it into a chapter and take the keys and do it right. But like the sponsor has a 29 or a 30 maturity and all they need is money, welcome to the deal away market, right? So they don't have to engage with their lenders. And I think that is part of the problem. Now, granted, these guys probably don't want to own some of these companies and maybe you're better off with that sponsor and a fixed balance sheet, right? The reality is, it's not usually that we sit down with these guys and they're like, oh, do you want the keys or do you want to be an LME? That's not the option unless you get a really near date of maturity and you go hold the line.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the problem too. Sure, these guys could fix the balance sheet and restructure the business, but you need a willing participant on the other side of the table. And you may just get the sponsor pull back if Rory's walks into the room and is looking for the keys.
How does an LME actually start? There is this, I would say, recurring narrative in the market, which I personally don't necessarily agree, especially what we've seen in court with Altice USA, with the anti-co-op lawsuit, that creditors are acting like a cartel, using co-ops to pressure companies. But the framing often skips over what actually sets these things in motion. And it's in the cases like Altice France, we've seen Patrick Drahi just moving assets away in the middle of the negotiations and scaring lenders just because he was able to do that. Sometimes we focus too much on creditor and creditor violence and behavior when it's frequently the sponsor who's pulling the trigger to extend their optionality.
I think you said it. Creditor on creditor violence is a beautiful headline. It can sell a lot of clicks. But practically speaking, by definition, all of these transactions have to start with the company and the sponsor because the company and the sponsor has asymmetric information. They know what issues are availing the business in a way that a creditor simply cannot know. And as a result of that, I think people point to some of these LME transactions that were done before LME, your 2019 type transactions, things of that nature. But in the modern LME world, those are driven by the sponsor company evaluating their options, having documents that they negotiated that provide flexibility to do a third party LME or a required lender LME. And I say that because those are very different transactions and I think sometimes they get lumped together. And once they make a determination that a transaction is something they want to pursue, then that's typically when lenders will get some sort of engagement. Now, lenders, obviously, Kevin manages the portfolio well. We manage our portfolio well. We're going to see things, be like, hey, this is on my watch list. I'm concerned about that. I need to be following it. But at the end of the day, a liability management transaction occurs only when the sponsor determines that they want it to occur.
That's 100% the case, right? The creditors get blamed for everything, but they can't do these deals with each other. So there needs to be interaction from the other side of the table. Now, granted, you bring up co-op agreements. Some of that is just a function of who's across the table from you and what's been their historical pattern of behavior. There are certain sponsors that are white shoe and their debt could trade in the 70s and they're never going to do anything. And does that situation need a co-op? Probably not. The other sponsor who's dropped down assets and ripped the faces off their creditors and other portcos, not surprisingly, people learn from history, right? So they're a little bit more front-footed in those situations. It's what you said about LMEs are all bespoke, which I tend to agree with. So are each one of these situations and how you approach them, right? It's not a one-size-fits-all at all.
The only thing I would add is on the co-op point, there's a lot of game theory that goes into the lead-up to these LMEs. How can we get to a transaction? What are sponsor incentives? You look at the maturity dates, the catalyst. How's this going to play out, Scott? Mentions history and we know the sponsors and the playbook and have a sense of how to get there. The type of co-op that gets put in place is going to help facilitate that. Is it going to be a simple majority co-op, a come one, come all type of agreement? Because we all have our own duty to get the best outcome for our investors. So if I'm being set up in a situation where it has to be a simple majority co-op, not to bury the lead, it's always better to be in the group than not in the group. And I was put into that position in part by the chessboard that was in place. These things can always be solved with additional equity support, by the way. To the point of it comes from sponsors leading lenders into these situations where there is that could be a more aggressive deal with advantaged and disadvantaged lenders or a more comprehensive solution is individual and specific to that instance and credit.
It's all bespoke. These are all individual games. These are all individual analyses, and you're trying to figure that out. Kevin's saying it in a really nice way. It's like there has never been a CLO that has woken up and wanted to do an LME. That has literally never happened. They are CLO because that basically means that the investment didn't go the way that you wanted. And so once that happens, you then adjust and you play the board that's been dealt to you. But that was never the goal.
interesting too, though, because you mentioned, right, the sponsor could always come with more capital, which is great, right? It just never happens. Vehicle's always at the end of life. Like there's always an excuse why they don't have dollars. The one thing we saw in SFR, which was a little bit different because it's more of a European-based credit, was Drahi wasn't putting in capital, but he was giving up significant equity as part of a deal. So almost like a mini recap out of court. Versus in the US, where like sometimes feels like we're taking a discount for the sake of taking discount and like figuring out what the right deals to get done. I have seen, and I know for CLO is not necessarily the right answer, but I have seen a little bit of that in a couple of deals I'm working on, in a good way, I think, a pollution of that SFR structure back into some of my US-based deals where sponsors that are truly at the end of a vehicle, end of life, they can't put in more money, are saying, we get it, we need to compensate you, but we're going to compensate you with equity and try to align our incentives together. Refix the balance sheet. I have one that's 51-49, and it's a well-known sponsor. So there is some benefit of having that sponsor in place. It was a tough investment, but a great track record sponsor, generally speaking. So I think we'll see, because it's obviously equity is not the best compensation for some of these structures. But I think you'll see a little bit more of that this year, because we have a couple now in the US that I historically hadn't really seen that, where there was like material equity going to our guys as part of the trade for taking a discount.
I think that makes a lot of sense for some of these, right? It's when the incentives are aligned, just to the point of there have been a lot of situations where everyone loses. Maybe we should do it differently.
Yeah.
And then I think at our conference in Miami, some CLO managers mentioned how there are some changes now, some loopholes maybe for CLOs to actually try to own some equity, given what's happening in the market. I don't know if that's something that you're seeing or not.
It is. So this started a bunch of years ago. I don't know if we'd call it LME 1.0. There have been so many iterations. CLOs were definitely on their heels. They did not have the tools to be competitive, and distressed funds and hedge funds could take advantage of the limitations of the document. I think that's largely been solved, and it's been solved for a few years to where all of our CLOs have those tools available, can participate in things like an equity rights offering and protect their recoveries. I think the investor base understood it was critical to give these structures the ability to participate and play defense in those situations, because it was an easy way to extract value just as a result of the structure holding the investment.
And not to be a forced seller.
Correct.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of you guys, without getting into specific funds, have your credit funds that could back up the CLO funds. And I see it on the front lines where the CLO has a toehold position, the credit fund sitting in the background. All of a sudden, they're three times the size because they like what they're seeing from an information perspective. So you guys have gotten a lot more sophisticated in the way they're structured with the bullet cap.
I think people have to remember, like, markets are not static. That's what makes them so much fun. That's why we're involved in them. People get smarter. They change. People understand them better. And what you're seeing over the last 5-6 years is that the market is getting smarter. Like the first LME deals versus the new LME deals were completely different. You talked about co-ops, right? The first co-ops compared to the co-ops now, with tiered structures and limitations on purchases and different treatment. Like, people start to say, hey, I saw what happened on these other examples. I'm going to tweak it. Like the addition of equity or warrants, all that stuff is just, let's try to make this mousetrap better. And that's why I think that, like, you'll keep seeing it evolve and try to fill a need, because at the end of the day, it was said earlier, Chapter 11 is wildly expensive. The way that it is structured, there are a lot of incentives for value destruction by parties that don't actually have any real claims, but they can cause a lot of holdup value. And as the expense of that goes up, that holdup value goes up, it makes it less and less appealing. Liability management is simply a reaction to that reality. And so until you have that process more streamlined and some of the costs that are being put on there more moderated, you're just going to keep seeing more and more stuff. And we would always prefer, if we're going to do handover fees, to do it out of court. And we've done multiple out of court transactions. Like, I've done multiple here. And they're great when you can do them. And you can figure it out and you come to a solution, and we've done that. I think that when we can do those transactions, they're great when they can happen. But it depends on the chessboard. It depends on the circumstance. It depends on the sponsor. Some sponsors have certain behaviors. Some sponsors have other behaviors. And I will say that there's no casting of aspersions. Kevin said they're trying to do what's best for their investors, and they have a responsibility to do that legally.
And in private credit, I know you said you're looking at that too.
Private credit names generally have fewer lenders. There are exceptions to that rule. They generally are smaller, different types of businesses. And so the benefit of doing a transaction as a liability management when you're looking at the board may not exist there. you might, because it's a smaller group, be like, actually, like, I can do an out-of-court transaction. I can do some sort of equity swap transaction that he's talking about. I think that for the structures that have more and more lenders, they start to behave a lot more like standard BSL. I think that as there are more structures that have dozens of lenders and et cetera, you'll start to see them operate a little bit more like that. But there's also a dynamic of no sponsor, no lender really wants there to be a whole bunch of publicity around an LME and the private credit deal. It's not beneficial. And so I think that's also the aspect of it. But as that market grows, inevitably there will be issues. And as we said before, it's a solution to certain types of issues. So I'm sure there will be some of these bigger structures with a bunch of lenders that choose to go that path.
We've seen a lot of co-ops after the lawsuit was filed, the anti-co-op lawsuit against Optima of his USA. Has anything changed in the market? What's the actual reaction in the market to this lawsuit?
We're going to continue to sign co-ops. They're effective tools to hopefully have lenders be able to negotiate a fair and right deal on more equal footing. And look, they also help the sponsor too in those situations, because we can reach consensus on a transaction that gets them what they need as well, and hopefully a more streamlined process. But we're going to continue to sign co-ops and look to use them as necessary, depending on the situation.
Can I call you the father of co-ops?
Please don't.
Think about
it. No, look, in all seriousness, these are the clients, obviously, but I've seen no slowdown in the use of co-ops. I think we, the night that litigation got filed in an unrelated deal, we like extended one to maturity just because of what was going on in the deal dynamics at the time without hesitation. Are we getting more of questions from people's internal counsel just pushing the envelope on questions with antitrust? Yes, but they should be, right? Those are good questions and we should be prepared to answer those. But I haven't seen a slowdown whatsoever. And there's a comedy to this litigation. Obviously, some of this was meant to be scare tactics, right? And they found the right customer in Drahi to do it. But the reality is, as Kevin was saying, in a world in which it was the first co-ops, come on, come all, everyone's locking arms. I still don't think it's an antitrust issue, but I understand why a sponsor may not like that from a negotiating leverage. Most co-ops nowadays, I would say, predominantly have at a minimum some concept of a carve-out premium. And candidly, that allows you to start getting into differentiated treatment, which in some respects is leaning into the LME. So there is a certain irony because these co-ops, at least the current form of what I see most co-ops, are set up to engage in an LME transaction, not to put the sponsor on the sideline and not be able to transact with its creditors.
Yeah, there's no change. There's no change. And I think there's a point that Kevin said that's really important. The document requires collective action, 100%. It literally requires that if Kevin and I are in a deal that we talk and figure out what relief you want to give. And I think that's why the market is shrugged, because to say that co-ops aren't permitted flies in the face of the basic fundamentals of how a credit agreement is drafted. I think that if you actually look at the structural things that have happened, and you also just take into the factor that at this point, most of the major funds have participated in some form of an LME, that to me portends that you're going to have more aggressive LME on balance if needed by the situation than less, precisely because you have people that are familiar with it. You have documents that explicitly are more permissive of it. You have co-ops that explicitly outline it. It becomes more difficult to make some of the arguments that people have made in the past. And you have participants, no matter where they end up falling in a given deal, that have been on multiple sides of it. It just creates an environment in which it becomes simply standard market practice, which would then over time allow more creative and more complicated, and as a result, potentially more aggressive transactions to happen.
And I have one more question before we wrap up on documentation, because it's clearly driving up outcomes more than ever. And you mentioned that. So one new protection, maybe Scott, you can talk about this here, or some features do you expect to see in 2026 documents based on recent litigation and what we've seen in the markets?
Can I ask a clarifying question? Do you mean like new issue BSL, or do you mean post-LME documents?
I was thinking post-LME documents.
Post, it's just the list of all the LMEs, whether it's Cirro protection or J.Crew protection or Chewy protection. You find it in, certainly when we close documents on the back end of a transaction, we make sure, and sometimes we have a blanket anti-LME protection. So I think, you guys tell me, I don't think you're seeing it. The primary market is, you'll see some J.Crew and things like that, but the level of those type of protections is typically when we have a shot at closing the goal through, whether it's an A&E or an LME or what have you. I got to tell you, you and I have lived through a couple of these. You got to be careful, because to our point that not all these LMEs work, if we just close the document too much and there's another blip 6-12 months, you're into a chapter, which may not be the result any of us want. Of course, none of us want egg on our face. We do an LME. The idea is the sponsor's got it shot. They're not going to be able to do a deal away from us a second time. But I do think there is some benefit to leaving the door open, whether it's rec lender or supermajority or what have you, that they can bring the deal back through that set of lenders. So they're a little bit of a balancing act.
Yeah, I think you, for post-LME docs, right, we're laser focused on shutting it down. There's a bunch of provisions we have. There's a bunch of items we have on our list that we focus on. There are things that we try to push. Scott has seen on some things, like I get focused on some things that I would love to have in docs. We get them sometimes, not always, like escrow for asset sales. It's a big deal. If you can do it, it completely changes the dynamic without boring people with some of the technical aspects of it. Most people's asset sale provisions are wide open for abuse. They just don't realize it. And the simplest way to do that is escrow. People at docs and all that stuff, if you actually know technically how that works, it doesn't mean anything, or it doesn't mean what they think it means. And so that's a very good way to be like, hey, no problem. But once it's in escrow, it's not part of the bankruptcy estate. There's a way to separate it. And so it allows you to have a little bit more flexibility. So if the business has legitimate uses for the money, they can use it for CapEx, et cetera. But if they want to sell an asset and kind of wait and then they file, then that cash is basically can be used as a leverage point. But there's a lot of different things, your unsubs, non-guarantor restricted subsidiaries, non-loan parties in general, all these different provisions that you have to have an understanding. But it's a balance, right? Because businesses have to be able to operate. And it goes back to the point about all this stuff is bespoke. And all this stuff is also relationship-based, like different sponsors will get different treatment. But I think that from a post-LM document, you have it. Obviously, you guys have talked about in the past, there's a DQ list aspect, which seems to pop up more and more in negotiations, which, you know.
We've seen it even this year, like it's still continuing.
It's a standard thing. And you got to understand it from a sponsor perspective, they're trying to control what's going to happen and who they're dealing with. It makes sense.
Isn't it taking away a little bit of the liquidity?
That's the tension, right? It takes away the liquidity.
Or they just start sitting on trades.
Different arguments for and against it. And if you look at it from the different people's perspective, it goes back to the fundamental truth that was said earlier. People are trying to do whatever maximizes the value for their investors. And so different people will have different opinions on things depending on how it affects them.
I think what's interesting is Worries earlier was talking about the air pocket that has occurred in loan trading. And in part, that's because the distressed community says, hey, I'll let the CLO guys figure out the LME. And after you tighten the document down and get rid of the games, I can now focus on the credit and re-underwrite the structure and not have to worry about that.
Loopholes in document.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so having that liquidity is important. I think the hope is that when you tighten the document, it isn't just I'm a holder. I don't have to worry about a third-party deal or moving collateral. It's now this can bring liquidity back into those instruments. The one thing I would pick on a little bit is actually what's occurring in the primary markets.
Because you have the two hats, right? The slow side.
Is the portability. That's something that exists in Europe. We're seeing that with how much demand there is in primary come back into the US and clear, albeit in larger structures where there's only so many accounts that can actually buy that asset anyway. But, you know, we have great relationships with our sponsors. We have a private debt business. We originate and work directly with them. And there are certain sponsors who definitely deserve a little bit more debt, tighter pricing given their track records, and the market gives that to them. However, that becomes a monetizable asset, especially for an existing portco, where that company can fall into the hands of someone who maybe doesn't deserve those premiums or that level of debt, but now has a looser document, control of the company. And that's where you can start to have LME come back into the fold, is that was once a good business can be monetized in a way that was different than when lenders initially made the loan.
There's always a game within a game, and it keeps you on your toes, which makes it really interesting. But this is the point, right? There's always something else to think about, right? You could imagine that someone could find that a very lucrative way to allow someone else to buy a business for them. It's a tricky thing because, as you said, it's a relationship, right? For the sponsors, they've been really good. You want to give them the better deal because they deserve the better deal.
This is a small parenthesis on First Brands. I'm just curious if you learned anything from the free fall, from the fraud behind it. You're talking about underwriting principles when syndication comes, right? Are you looking at due diligence in another way, or did you talk to your analysts the way they look at companies?
That onion's still being peeled back.
I think, look, disclosure has gotten worse and worse over the years in our market. And we have to rely on the numbers that are being posted to data sites, the sign-off of auditors, what bankers are telling us, and then our own work to try to dig as deep as possible. And I think the game only gets harder. Markets only get tougher. And so we're pushing our analysts. You have to dig deeper, leverage the networks. We subscribe to a lot of tools that are beyond what you would get in a regular way data site to try to bolster the underwriting process and put the organization in as best, you know, position as we can. My hope is that disclosure improves, that there are higher requirements on these issuers. I don't think we're going to necessarily get it, especially given how much demand there has been. But that would be my dream big ask.
As I said before, we weren't involved in First Brands. We didn't get involved in the structure due to some other stuff. And I think Kevin's right. Like, you look at everything as a learning opportunity. I look at all the transactions we're not involved in, the LMEs, the Chapter 11s, and it goes back to the same thing, right? You need to do fundamental credit work as best as you can, get as much information, get as much touch points. I think that's the lesson there. I'm sure there's going to be people saying, oh, I need to look at all the off-balance stuff. I need to go check that stuff. Every credit is bespoke. And so it's just a reminder that try to get as much information as you can.
Any final thoughts or key takeaways you'd like to leave our listeners before we wrap up?
I think we covered the gamut. I think you're going to see more of what you've been seeing for the last couple of years this year. And I tend to agree with Kevin, just from what I'm seeing in my pipeline, I think you're going to see an uptick in the chapters as well. Despite the state of the market, I think I get this question from my own firm executive committee when they see what the market's doing and then see us being really busy. I think we'll continue to stay busy despite an economy that's actually doing pretty well.
I'd echo that. But the public markets are a few thousand companies. There's a lot of other companies in the world. And
fair point.
That all the rest of them are in our world, which I think sometimes gets lost. Look, I think that if I had a takeaway, it's what we talked about. There's going to be a lot of things to take care of defensively. There's going to be a lot of opportunities offensively. It's maintaining underweight in things that we think are going to be challenging and picking and choosing spots. I think that my view and my take from this, from the jump, has been embrace change, be adaptable. I've learned that from a lot of mentors coming up. I think if you look at the places where there's been a lot of difficulties for folks, it's when people have resistance to changing to the market. I think that the places where there was a resistance to understanding LME, how it works, the nuances of it, people are playing catch up. I think really understanding your credit docs, they're negotiated. And like I said, you could have the entire economic terms of a credit doc on one page. The rest of the stuff is what happens when things go wrong and what are investors and LPs pay us for what are you going to do when things go wrong? And so that's my takeaway. Focus on that stuff. Do your bread and butter credit. And always remember what you're reading and understand why it works the way it works.
For me, it's if anything, it's on the capital solution side. I think we've seen a lot of tough LMEs that have gotten done in the marketplace, but there's a lot of maturities that are sitting in front of us that need to be dealt with in the next 3 years. And these are companies that haven't had to go through an LME, that have dealt with a lot of headwinds, inflation, interest rates, tariffs, and the like, that create a big opportunity need and a solution to help facilitate the extension and allow the thesis to play out. So for us, we're going to be spending a lot of time looking at those types of businesses, trying to think creatively to come up with something that can work for the sponsor and for us and lead to hopefully some great outcomes. And I think that's what we're looking forward to in 2026.
I'm looking forward to working on one of those with you right now, trying to figure that one out.
On that note, we'll bring today's discussion to a close. Thank you for your insights, and thank you to our listeners as well for tuning into this episode of That Wired. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode on Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our That Wired team at thatwired.com.